Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
My guest today is Paul Young. He's the author of The Shack, a book that has sold a couple of copies, around 22 million, I believe, actually. It's been 105 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's about to be released in the next couple of weeks as a major motion picture. It's going to be in theaters North America March the 3rd, and I've got Paul on the show today for the next 40 minutes. So I hope you stay tuned. We talk about what it means to be human, actually, as corny as that might sound. But we talk about things like shame and authenticity and fear and about loneliness and how we aren't alone and that we were all created to be loved. Love is clearly a theme that runs through this conversation, without a doubt. And probably one of my favorite things is this idea of authenticity and how we touch on this idea of the holiness of the other. And I think that's a really brilliant starting point for pretty much everything. Find out more about how the book was written, why it was written, how it's become a major motion picture, coming out on March the 3rd. The Shack is the book. It is also the film starring Sam Worthington and Octavia Spencer. How cool is that? And davidpecklive.com for more information about my podcasting, my speaking, and my writing. Rabble.ca for more podcasts there, too. And stay tuned for Paul Young and as we talk about The Shack.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today, someone who has been on Face to Face a couple of times now. I think this might be the third interview with our guest today. Paul Young is here today. We're going to talk about a whole lot of things, but most importantly, we're going to talk about the new film, The Shack, coming out in theaters March the 3rd. Paul, thanks for your time.
Yeah. I love being with you, David. You know that, but that's because I love you. You know.
Thanks, man. That's gonna have an impact on where we head with our questions. I think 22 million copies sold. 105.
I know.
105 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and
that doesn't include today.
and I was just gonna say, and the news is of late that it's back on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, it's climbing up there. It's at number 6 as of this week. So who knows? How funny is this? You know, you make 15 copies at Office Depot as a Christmas present, and you give them away, and you go back to work. And this is all, you know, the crazy God sense of humor stuff. I love it.
So really quickly, because we've got about a half an hour together here, Paul, and we'll probably do, we're going to do ongoing interviews, I'm sure, but give us the really sort of the I guess what it is, you're Canadian and American, give us the Coles and or Cliff Notes version of the story and how now we're seeing this on screen.
So the Cliff Notes are, I wrote a story for my kids for Christmas back the year I turned 50, and it was at the bequest of my wife Kim, who had said, basically, you know, would you just write something that puts in one place how you think, because you think outside the box? And that's what I did. I didn't feel healthy enough to do it before I turned 50. That tells you something. I mean, I come from a modern evangelical fundamentalist Protestant background.
I'm so sorry about that, Paul.
Well, it just meant that I had further to go than most people.
And, right. So, gee, I wonder how many people we've already alienated on this interview.
Oh, you know. Hang in there, folks. Because I'm one of you. And, you know, the people that get upset and alienated are usually my own people. So,
right.
Yeah. And the work that it took to get to a place to be able to write this was long and arduous. So the weekend that the main character Mackenzie spends in the shack represents an 11-year journey for me. And but I didn't want to write an 11-year book for my kids.
Right.
War and Peace in Oregon.
That's right, yes.
And, so I wrote it. I gave it to them for Christmas. You know, thanks, Dad. A book. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, isn't this wonderful? It. Yeah.
So it took them a while, but my friends were all over it, and they started giving it to their friends who gave it to their friends, and that started the whole chain reaction. Ended up in the hands of some guys in California who thought it should be a movie, and that started the conversation about actually publishing it. 26 publishers turned it down.
Wow.
So two of those guys create a publishing company. One volunteers to books out of it at night because he's putting in people's sprinkler systems during.
So, that's fantastic.
You know, it's
yeah.
just this wild, crazy thing. I'm working three jobs. I'm cleaning toilets and shipping out soldering tips, all this. The storyline is fundamentally human. That is, it involves loss and love,
Nice.
And which all human beings experience. This is what we have in common. Other than the depth of our humanity, we all know love and loss. And it's a story about a man who loses a child. Youngest child is abducted on a camping trip, and then he gets invited back to the place of that great loss and sadness in a mysterious sort of way. That the invitation could be from the perpetrator, it could be just someone's sick idea of a joke, or as crazy as it sounds, it could have been from God. And he goes back thinking maybe finally that God that he grew up with might show up and be helpful, but that God doesn't. And in that, I'm trying to make this real basic statement for my kids. I don't want you growing up with the God that I grew up with, because I don't think that God exists. That God never showed up and was never helpful. But I do want to introduce you to the character and nature of the God that I did meet and who did show up and heal my broken heart. So it all unfolds inside of that. Mackenzie's the main character. He's dealing with his loss and his questions, and they're very human questions. I think that's partly why the book has had such an impact, and I think the movie will too, is because it's not a religious story. It's a story about relationship, and that relationship is not only about how we deal one with another, but also about our faith and how do we deal with that in the midst of losses?
I've heard you say before that the shack, not trying to reduce what you say to just phrases, but you've said quote, it's a conversation about God that isn't religious.
Correct, that's what the book did. It gave people a language to have that conversation, and it also validated their own story. You know, stories. Every human being is a story, and that story matters. And we're just too busy to take the time to listen to them.
Well, and Paul, isn't the reality that we don't, most of us, even if we don't believe in God at all, of any kind, shape, or form, we have this understanding of some kind of, a friend of ours would say, a faceless, austere omni-being, this entity
yeah.
with a big stick. Even if we don't believe in a God of any kind, an entity or an energy of any kind, that's sort of the understanding, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that we personify the thing that we're most afraid of and the thing that we're most attracted to. And so, you know, we know there's evil in the world. We know that, you know, we've broken things ourselves. And there is a sense that something requires balance or payment or that. And I can understand why we have created not only in an inherent sense, but a very extrinsic sense, that there is a an omni-being out there that will bring justice. I mean, and it proliferates all of our art and everything else. We want justice.
Mm.
But we don't know how to deal with the whole love side of things. And
right.
So we create the sense that our attraction is to something bigger than ourselves, something more beautiful than ourselves, and or more authentic. And we're driven in that direction, but at the same time, we're so full of shame and so surrounded by a performance production society that our value is connected to that, that we just transmit that on to any sense of faith that we have. I think this is one of those things I'm thinking about right now, and that is, I don't believe that God is a religious being at all.
Hmm.
At all. Has never been a religious being. That is, there's never been a time, and I'm pretty Orthodox, so I love the idea of the Trinity, that there's always been face-to-face, other-centered, self-giving relationship, but from before creation, which means that there is a basis for both love and relationship, a valid basis. And with that in mind, I can't even begin to imagine that there's an order of service in the relationship of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You know, it's like, who's opening in prayer today? The Holy Spirit, are you doing communion? The whole idea is bizarre, but what that means is that every form of religion that exists on this planet is something that we have brought to the table.
Right.
And what's profound about that, it means that history is a story of how God climbs into and accommodates what we have brought to the table. And by joining us in those things, whatever religion that you happen to have a persuasion toward, whether it's even the faith of atheism, which is dependent on the concept of God, right? So whatever it is, and whatever your practices are that have come out of that, God climbs into it in order to destroy anything that is not true from the inside out. And I think that's the story of Scripture, right?
I think
it's a whole new way to look at Scripture that kind of now makes more sense.
Well, and I'd love to talk about the film. I got to see it yesterday. It was a real treat to see it with about, a VIP screening. Come on, how cool is that, right? In Toronto.
How'd you get there?
What's that?
I said, how did you get invited?
Yeah, exactly. I had a bit of a connection.
Invited, so it tells me something about you being you're a very important person, brother.
So, thanks. So, I don't want to talk too much about the film because we don't want to, we don't want to give it away too much, but I do have a couple moments that I want to bring up. Before we go there, you said something just a couple of minutes ago where you said, it's a film or it's a story. I think you were just talking about the book before the film, and the film, I think we can say the same thing. It's about, it's about being human. It involves loss and love. How come it took you, say it was an 11-year journey, that got you to the place where you could write the book. How come it took you so long to figure out that you were loved?
Oh, because I grew up in a religious environment. So I had a very angry father, and I was first born, and experienced sexual abuse as a child, and both inside the tribal culture I grew up, and then inside of boarding school. And so my concept of God was very much wrapped into performance approval.
Mm.
And so I wasn't loved for who I was. I was always loved for what I could do,
right.
Produce.
Right, perform. Nice.
Yeah, and so, when the whole world tells you, and you've been telling yourself because of so much shame in your history, that you're a piece of crap, and then you have a theology that comes along and tells you the same thing, that the truth of your being is that you're a piece of crap, you're kind of trying to build something out of a swamp or quicksand.
Hmm.
And And it's only good as fast as you can build something before it sinks. And so you have this perpetual cycle that's always based on your ability to perform. And that's where the metaphor of the shack comes in as something deeper, the house, the broken heart of a human being, where you store all of your addictions and you hide all of your secrets and you don't want anybody in there because you're terrified that they will look at you with the same disgust that you see in the mirror. And so all of those things are impediments to any concept of knowing that you're loved. You know, it took me 50 years to wipe the face of my own father off the face of God, let alone deal with the theology that told me that God the Father was this omni-being that Jesus came to save me from. And I couldn't perform well enough to get any kind of sense of approval or affection that was lasting. So I had a lot of crap to work out. And, so
in the film, I think it's Octavia Spencer who says at some point that and she's talking about healing, it's about, the quote is, a bit of time and a lot of relationship.
A lot of relationship, yep. Yeah, see, and here's another concept that goes back to my view of God, is that I don't believe God was ever alone.
Right.
And I don't think aloneness has any part of how we're created in the image of God. So any sense of aloneness has to do with the darkness that we brought to the table. And that's why relationship matters. We're designed for it. We're created inside of it. And it's absolutely essential if we're going to be exposed, if we're going to experience the gift of exposure and come to healing.
I got to say, just to shift gears a little bit, and then I'm going to ask you a way more serious question. They're all serious questions, by the way, Paul. Okay. The Gideon Bible scene is hysterical.
Oh, I put it in the book, you know, and I put it in the book because it is hysterical. And it was such a light touch. And I love the way they did it. I don't think they could have done it any better.
Yeah, it's good. So do you think there's going to be an audience? I mean, it's really, you know, obviously you're hoping for a wider audience. You want more people to come to the table. You want more people to crack the cover of the shack and to come to it again and to peel back more layers and all those things. And it's going to be a catalyst for conversation, no doubt. I mean, as I said to you before the recorder was going, a truly moving experience for me on so many levels, and I'm going to have to see it again for a variety of reasons. Do you think that there are some people who are gonna come to this and say at a certain point, oh, no, just, whoa, still too much God talk for me. Still too, it's like, and they won't see it for, you know, what it maybe really is. And just, you know, when it finally does make it to Netflix or they get it on DVD, they won't be able to get through it because it's just because of the brokenness or because of the filter. I guess is maybe, like you said, 50 years to wipe the face of your father off the face of God.
Yeah, and that's true with the book, too. A lot of people couldn't make it chapter one just because,
right.
You know, they're bringing to the table huge and great sadnesses, their own losses. And
right.
And so it's a timing thing for a lot of folks.
Right,
yes,
that's good.
Some people, yeah, it will. There will be some folks who they just, It is too much God talk, and I understand that. I mean, I was with a whole bunch of missionary kids last summer up in the Cameron Highlands in Malaysia, and we were meeting back at a boarding school that had so damaged them. And some of them, I mean, they would count, and if you mentioned God or Jesus six times, they counted. And if you hit six, they'd get up and walk out. It was too much.
Wow.
Because of so much damage. And they're, you know, they're like a porcupine with all these infected quills that anything that touches it, you know. And I get that. I totally get that. So, and you know me and you know my heart. You know that when I made 15 copies at Office Depot, those things did everything I ever wanted that book
yep.
to do. But I'm watching the ripples of this conversation moving out into the human conversation, and it has provided a safe space to have this conversation. And people are going to come from all kinds of histories and issues and trauma and things like this and interact with this
now, the film, and for a lot of folks, you know, who will never read a book, the film is going to be the way in for this, for them, for this conversation.
Paul, I was kind of surprised in a way at the film at how deep it really goes. You know, the conversations, the questions that are raised, and was The Shack for you, was this really about sort of dealing with the classic problem of evil?
Yeah.
And coming to terms with that? Because that, I mean, that's obviously a central theme of the book. It's a central theme of the film. It's Max, you know, kind of coming to terms with his daughter's death, his horrific death, right? But it's more than that, way more than that. But was that kind of your way into this?
Yeah, because when I wrote this, and I'm thinking, like, I'm writing this for my kids. And we have six children, and our youngest was 13 at the time. And I'm thinking about the greatest loss a human being can experience is the loss between a parent and a child.
Mm.
And I think I'm so glad, and I think that's part of the nudge of the Holy Spirit, that I went to that place, even in a story for my kids, because when you go down to the deepest loss, you are suddenly picking up all the other losses along the way. And it did that. But people would say, you know, how could you do this as a gift for your kids? And I'm going, like, what if something happens to one of my grandchildren, one of their children, and what if I'm not there? What would I want to say to them?
Right.
But how would I want them to deal with the question about the character and the goodness of God in a world that is absolutely broken and brings so much pain to the table? So how do you deal with that question? And what's beautiful about the film, and it's true about the book, it didn't give a transactional religious answer to it.
Right.
It pushed you into the mystery of relationship, into the goodness of God, into a high view of humanity, and it gave space, but it told you you're not alone.
Right.
You'll never be. And the mystery of relationship begins to become the framing of the question, which changes it completely.
Well, I would imagine people are going to find it difficult on a variety of levels to get through. Some will find it, wow, this, you know, they'll watch the film and they'll have a certain experience and they'll have a conversation about it and so on and so forth. But I think some will find it. And I think even after all my years and my history, and you know mine pretty well too, it's kind of confusing still. Hang on a minute. Octavia Spencer, which, by the way, is utterly brilliant casting. Utterly brilliant. And there's a couple scenes with her that are just absolutely magical. And for the listeners out there who are going to go see it, remember the flowers. The flower cooking, baking with Mac in the hands, maybe my favorite moment in the whole film. Brilliant casting. So, but it's confusing, Paul. It's confusing in the sense that, well, hang on a minute here. this isn't God. What are you talking? Like, what are you doing to me? Right?
How many times in your life have you ever changed without being in some sense of a confused state? You know?
Fair enough. Yeah.
So when everything's going great and everything feels like it's under control, we don't change, you know, we don't go deeper. And so anything, I love the fact that it creates this, what's the phrase?
Well, there's a disconnect there. There's a tension. This isn't what I've been told. This isn't what I've been taught. This isn't my understanding.
Cognitive
dissonance. Yeah.
That's the phrase. And you experience it, but you get sucked into the relationality of it, and before your head can even kind of set up its boundaries and create the illusions that we so, the assumptions that we so live with, and that's the beauty of someone like Octavia coming right through your defenses. It reminds me of an article that the president of Denver Seminary wrote about The Shack when it first came out. And he said, I don't care what a Pharisee you are, but didn't you want to be inside the embrace, in Papa's embrace?
Nice.
Yeah. And this is it. You know, we've got very rigid constructs that have become part of our assumptions that need to be challenged because they're impediments to moving into something that is more beautiful and deeper and will open up a possibility of becoming authentic human beings, fully alive and fully free. And I think that dissonance is absolutely essential. And when you feel it, it tampers with your sense of certainty. But we're control freaks, you know, right. As human beings. We're so full of fear that we'd rather believe in our own power to control our destinies than take the risk of trusting anyone, you know, especially invisible people.
That's pretty funny. Yeah. Invisible.
It's so true, though. You know, so I love it. And you know, I'll give you an example of dissonance. I've had at least 5 emails from, I call them my people because they are, you know, evangelical fundamentalists. And at least 5 emails that say, how dare you make Jesus a Middle Easterner? What? Because they felt the cognitive dissonance. They have an image of Jesus being, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, British-speaking, you know, guy, because they've seen it in the movies.
Right.
And when you see a Viva Louche, I tell you, your appreciation for Jesus is going to go right through those barriers. Didn't you love his character?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think the casting for overall is just really, what's the best way to put it? Really human. Really natural, really accessible and approachable. That's what I love. The skipping of the stones, the relatability of this, like you said, invisible person.
And he's Aviv is a Israeli Jew. I mean, he's from Tel Aviv, and we think it's the first time in a major motion picture that Jesus has actually been portrayed by a Jew who is Middle Eastern, just for anybody who has a question about it.
Right.
And it's this beautiful presentation of relationship. And there were some things that happened that were so cool that happened on set that they captured. I thought the first time I saw it that the butterfly that lands on Sam Worthington's nose as Mackenzie, I thought it was CGI. It's not.
It's natural. It's actually,
and all those swarm of butterflies that started to come around, they released some, but all these other butterflies showed up.
Wow, that's cool. I noticed the butterflies in the coffin, and I wondered if they where that was going to go, because that was very sort of subtle. There was no real focus on that. And then I don't know if it's connected, but it sure seems like it, back to the scene when they're packing up and they're getting ready to go, and Missy wants to bring the caterpillars. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's too good, right?
Oh man, there's so many subtle through lines, and the more you see it, the more you'll go like, oh my goodness, I totally missed that. Yeah.
Well, I hope it's huge, Paul, for so many reasons. Well, and what's nice about it too is it really is a family film. Like you could
very,
yeah, yeah. There's no reason why you can't experience that as a group, family, and just sort of hang out and chat about it afterwards. Oh man, I don't know where to go. So we've only got a few more minutes here, but so here I'm going to go here. So for me, another really favorite moment is this idea that God might collect our tears.
That's right out of Psalm.
I mean, it's so nice, right? It's so beautiful. It's so well represented in the film. It took me back to other fantasy. It took me back to C.S. Lewis. It took me back to Narnia, all kinds of things. But if my idea of God is the angry, stick-holding God who wants to punish me, and he collects tears, that's nowhere near as interesting or as healing or as loving or as inviting as this relational God that collects tears.
Well, it's incongruous. Why would a God who is angry all the time even care about
it?
Yeah, because, you know, in my relationship with my dad early on, because he didn't have the capacity for being a dad, my tears didn't. Him, you know, even him calling my name was more an issue of a fear response for me than anything. I didn't want to hear him call my name, you know. So a lot of us who have grown up with this distant, angry, punitive, retributive God, we're alone, because there is no way I'm going to run into the arms of someone who is then going to just beat the crap out of me.
Right.
Well, that's a little tender. So, yeah, it's the beauty of it is that our hearts respond at such a profoundly deep level to just the idea of being loving and authentic ourselves, to be an independent human being. And that drive is towards something. It has to have an origination and a basis. And I think it is in, you know, that, like people say, I don't know if I can trust that God is as good as you've written. And I'm going like, I wrote him as good as I know, and I know I just scratched the surface.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because I know that God is gooder than that. But I didn't grow up that way. You know, I grew up with God as a projection of my pain and my relationship with my dad and the abusers and all that kind of stuff. And that's why it took so long to deal with all of those lies. And all of us are in the middle of that journey.
I've read somewhere, Paul, and it might have been pretty recently, you might even have said it to me in a variety of ways over the years or in another interview, but for you, this is all about validating the holiness of other people's stories.
Absolutely. I tell people that's why we're born barefoot. You know, we are born to walk on the holy ground of each other's stories. But that's been a long journey. I started with a very low view of humanity because I had a super low view of myself.
Right.
And that also affected my view of Jesus, where he wasn't really human because, I mean, he was, but he was sort of like a magician, right? No demeaning magician.
Yeah, be careful, eh, Paul?
Yeah. But it was like, you know, well, when things got tough, he could pull a rabbit out of his hat.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And he was the magic trick human being. So on the one hand, there was a disconnect with the humanity of Jesus, but it was profoundly because I had such a low view of myself and a low view of humanity as a result, and our theology taught us that. And I don't think there's any hope forward until we begin to agree with the truth of who we are as revealed in the humanity of Jesus, rather than the theology that has so pushed us below the surface that we have to work 50 years to get to the surface. And so this is about the holiness of the other. When you begin to see, and then it makes sense why Jesus would say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Don't know what they're doing. If they knew who they are, then the way of their being, what they do, would automatically and naturally change.
Well, and just speaking of change, Paul, I mean, and this is where I think the potential is just so huge and continues to be huge for what you've done and for the Shack and for this, I don't know, can you call it a reinterpretation? But it changes everything because you kind of have to come back to it, or you have to at least be willing or open to come back to the story and say, oh, okay, well, if that's the case, take almost like a Socratic approach and say, well, if that's true, then what?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And how about all the, because yeah, there's inherently all these confrontations throughout the whole show, you know, throughout the whole movie, and throughout the book for sure, and that is about my unwillingness to forgive or take steps, or my judgmentalism. If there is anything that will confront us, it's my need to control the universe and make judgments over the other, rather than begin to see the other as this profound creation that is made in the image of a God who is a relational being who is only good. That goodness is the truth of their being, whether they know it or not. I mean, that is, even in my relationship with my dad, that is what has opened up the path toward even the possibility of something better than we had. And that is because I have begun to see him according to the truth of who he is, not according to the way that he has been, which has been an expression of his own damage and his own shame. And I know where he came from. I know what was done to him as a child. And so, you know, you'll see that scene with Sophia, the wisdom of God, and it is so confrontive.
Yeah, she's terrific. She's terrific, by the way. There's that. Yeah. I think it was Octavia Spencer who says to Mac at one part, quote, your problem is you don't think that I'm good.
Right.
And that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, that changes everything. If you start with that as a premise, you're kind of screwed. But if you know, so in a sense, for me, it's a bit of a philosophical. It's profoundly theological, but it's also a philosophical shift here, because we're talking about knowledge. We're talking about what we know and how we know.
Yep, exactly. So it covers it, and it talks about ontology. So
right.
You're not dealing with just epistemology. You're dealing with ontology,
sure,
and theology, which are, you know, and it's all philosophical. It's all about how we understand who we are in this universe that is a weaving of both things beautiful and things dark.
Mm.
And so, you know, is God a yin-yang? Is he a dualist? You know, is he part good, part bad, part light, part dark, you know? That there's no comfort in that. You know, there's got to be something more, or else everything loses its sense of meaning. And now you're back to some really fundamental philosophical
stuff. Yeah, sure. Well, I so love, and just before we wrap up and tell everybody where the film's going to be and when and all that. Oh, and by the way, your cameo was utterly astounding. It was brilliant.
reduce me
to tears, Paul, in a matter of seconds.
Yeah,
it was
right.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm so glad somebody came over to me before the screening and said, hey, watch out for this scene, because I think Paul's got a cameo there.
Yep.
Oh, it was awesome.
I think it only took 5 takes to walk through a scene.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, very Hitchcockian of you, actually.
That was actually Gil Netter's idea.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
I was thrilled.
Fun. The line, love leaves a mark, and I don't know if it was around the same, you know, but the idea that we were created, that we're here to be loved, man, it's one of the, I'm getting shivers just as I think about it. I honestly, I don't get out of bed in the morning that way. Certainly not every day. And,
no.
You know?
And a lot of us don't. I think the most of us don't. But the resonance of that so deeply impacts you, and then you start seeing it everywhere.
You see it everywhere, man. You see it yeah, in the lineup at the store and on the bus and when your train's delayed, and it's just, yeah, the implications are astounding.
Yeah, and we live in a world that's so generated by fear, all of our institutions and systems and our divisions and all that. And fear is always related to trust or control, and I love the First John stuff that says, to the degree that fear exists in your life, to that degree, you don't know yet how much you're loved.
Right.
Which is what that conversation is about. You know, a bird is designed to fly. You were designed to be loved. You know, you were created to be loved. But pain is a way of clipping our wings so that we forget we were ever created to fly.
Yeah, it's good. What? So tell me real quick, because we got to wrap it up. I hear you're going to be at the Museum of Modern Art in the next week or two. Tell me, use that as a story to lead into the March 3rd. Is it a worldwide release? Is it North American? What's the word?
It's North American, and then they've got an international release for dates, you know,
okay,
for other parts. But on February 28th, they have the red carpet premiere.
Nice.
in New York, and that's the one you're talking about at the Museum of Modern Art. Which, how fun is that? Like, cool.
It must seem so surreal to you, though. And you had mentioned to me too, just last week, you were doing a bit of a press junket, 60 interviews in a day, about the film and the book and all things The Shack related.
Yeah, it totally. And it's so fun. It is.
That's awesome.
It is. It's just fun. How cool. And part of it is probably because I have no idea what I'm doing. when you learn to live without expectations, everything's a gift.
Well, the beauty is if you don't go on to write another bestseller based on your cameo, I think you got a future in acting.
If they need kind of a little older, middle-aged, balding, low-grade makeup.
That's right. You'll be perfect for the role. It's Paul, what a delight chatting to you about the film, and once again, we barely scratched the surface. I hope everybody goes to see it. It's a beautiful, moving film, And coming up in Toronto, March 3rd release, or at least North America, March 3rd. Look for it everywhere. Yeah, listen, you've left a mark, man. It's huge.
Oh, brother. You know, how cool is it that we get to participate? All of us are leaving a mark. No, I have 9 grandbabies and a 10th on the way. I mean, every one of those babies is an eternal being who will leave a mark. I mean, that's way bigger than a book or a movie.
It's,
I mean, just
pretty cool.
It's the best.
Yeah, and it's a reason to be hopeful, it seems to me.
I am.
No,
I got nervous, so.
Well, listen, thanks for your time today. Paul Young's been joining us here on Face to Face, talking about The Shack, coming soon to a theater near you, March the 3rd. Thanks for your time, Paul.
You bet. Love you, David.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.